Questions? No questions? Graded.
Yes.
Going, gone. So, for a while we've been working on energy, and the idea was that if we found energy, we could get forces from it by taking derivatives and torques by taking derivatives. And we have this kind of odd statement that we have exactly the same formula for a force, for example, but with different signs. And it looks pretty funny, but we worked out why that's the case. In fact, they're giving us the same force, but we have an additional source of energy if we have a battery. The battery is sourcing charge, and so it's doing some work, and we needed to add that in, and that's why we get this apparently different direction. But in fact, it works out to be the same direction, just looks a little bit different. So kind of the important message of this chapter is that E dot D is the energy per volume. So if we want energy, that's one way we can calculate the energy. Of course, the other way is by taking half the charge times the voltage and adding that up. This is going to be a more effective way of doing it in general because we see that the energy is in the field there, not particles that are in a particular position. And you've worked homework problems now, and you see that as a result of going to a lower energy state, dielectrics get sucked into regions with large electric fields. And it obviously doesn't matter whether the electric field is going this way or that way. The only thing that matters is that it's bigger, and that'll be in a direction that's downhill. Questions on work and energy? So then went on to the next chapter where we're starting to deal with currents, building up to the idea of doing magnetic fields. And we kind of want something that's the equivalent of charge per volume, but for currents. So think about current flowing through seawater, for example. Every little piece of the seawater is carrying some current, but it's not in particular wires. And what we did is we talked about the current density J, which was the current that was going through a particular cross-sectional area. And as usual, if it's not going in perpendicular, we'd have the dot product of J with the perpendicular vector A. Okay, so even though this is the current through an area, this is a current density, and you'll see it really is kind of the equivalent of the volume charge density. So we could, if we're thinking about something like seawater again, where there are lots of things that could be carrying the charge, sodium ions, potassium ions, chlorine ions, and electrons, in general what we would do to figure out the charge density is we would take the number of them per volume times the charge and their velocity that they have. Now in general, they have a large random thermal velocity. It's going to cancel out when we do this sum, but they have a relatively slow drift velocity. So here we have that factoid that in general, these things are moving a lot faster than they're drifting. And fundamentally, it's the drift velocity that goes there. Although, as I say, if you average it up, it kind of doesn't matter. We think about this drift velocity as building up over some time between collisions. And exactly how you define that is up for grabs. So I've written it this time the way the book did it. But in any case, the drift velocity is proportional to the electric field times the time it takes to build up to that particular velocity. And if we plug that all in, we get a linear relationship between the current density and the electric field. And the corresponding factor is called the conductivity. And because our book doesn't want to use sigma and rho's, once again, they chose a letter that I don't think anyone else ever uses, G, to describe the conductivity. So most commonly, you'll probably see that listed as a sigma. And the conductivity is 1 over the resistivity, which most people will use a rho for, But again, our book doesn't like to use things a half dozen times to mean different things. So our book is going to use eta for resistivity. So eta is commonly used for things like viscosity, so it's kind of in the same ballpark as resistivity. So we kind of have current density per volume and surface currents and currents in wires as being equivalent to charge in a volume, charge on an area, and point charges. And we came up with this other factoid that if in fact we had a perfect lattice, then the conductivity would actually go to infinity, which is to say the resistivity would go to zero. And these apparent collisions are actually due to thermal dislocations. That if everything were in its proper place, the electrons could smooth between them and never be stopped. So of course, since this is due to thermal dislocations, if we reduce the temperature, then things are going to be more in their right spot. So this time between collisions is going to increase, which is going to mean that the conductivity is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the resistance is going to be approaching zero at low temperature. But not equal to zero the way it is for a superconductor. So there's a big difference between a small resistance and an exactly zero resistance. But for most any metal at low temperatures, the resistivity and the resistance are all going to go approximately to zero at low temperatures, and then be dominated by impurities in the crystal as opposed to thermal dislocations. This connection between drift velocity and electric fields, not uncommonly that's called the mobility, and the letter mu is often used for it. Questions? Going. Well, there two reoccurring themes that I hope you've seen, and that is we love to solve Laplace's equation, and we love to have, you know, integrals of things that have r minus r prime in them sort of stuff, right? Where r prime is pointing at the source, and r is where you're observing it. And we're integrating over all of the locations of those sources. Okay, so those are real takeaway messages from this class. This one we're not going to deal with today. That'll come back to haunt us next time. So one of the agenda items for today is to see how we can apply Laplace's equation to currents that are flowing. Laplace's equation is going to apply to pretty much everything. So Laplace's equation demands that we have the Laplacian of something, and typically it's been voltages, be zero, right? Where the Laplacian is, I presumably don't need to remind you, but in Cartesian coordinates at least, it's the sum of the squares of the derivatives. And this was true to start out with because we're in a vacuum, and we had Poisson's equation, which said the Laplacian was dependent upon the charge density. And then this became true in dielectrics, because even though there was charge present, the bound charge was proportional to the free charge. So if the free charge was zero, we still had solutions to Laplace's equation. So now we have stuff that is flowing. Can we still assume that something like Laplace's equation is going to be correct? Right, so basically, what we're asking is the divergence of the electric field zero, right? Because of course the electric field is going to be minus the gradient of the voltage. So what we know is that typically what we have is the current density is linearly proportional to, I'll use the book's G as long as I can remember, linearly proportional to the applied electric field. So is there any reason for the divergence of J to be zero? That's kind of what we're going to need if the divergence of the electric field is going to be zero. So this is the start of an important equation called the equation of continuity. And what the equation of continuity says is that basically charge is conserved the same way that energy is conserved. So if energy is leaving a volume, it must be because there's less energy than there was in the beginning. So if we think about a sphere, well, not a sphere, any old surface, we can calculate the rate that current is leaving that sphere. And that has to then be equal to the change in the total charge that's enclosed in that sphere. Okay, so the total charge enclosed, that's just going to be the integral of the charge density over the volume. The rate that stuff is leaving, well, we know that the little bit of current that's leaving is the current density dotted into the little bit of area. So we can add up all of the little exiting current that's leaving at that boundary. Okay, so what we've got then is that the time rate of change in that charge, if we add that to the stuff that's leaving, we better get zero. Okay, so if stuff is leaving, then this is going to be positive, and the total charge that's enclosed is going to be negative, and they're going to add up to zero. Okay, so kind of the trick is to use Gauss's theorem in reverse to change this surface integral into a volume integral, right? Because this is the same thing as the divergence of J integrated over the volume. And we've already said that this charge integral is equal to the integral of rho dv. So if we put these pieces together, what we have is the integral of the time derivative of the charge density plus the divergence of the current density integrated over volume has to be zero. And that has to be zero no matter what I choose to be my boundary. So for any volume, the current that's leaving has to equal the time rate of change in the charge that's enclosed. So if this is true for any volume, the only way that's possible is if this is equal to zero. Okay, so that's the equation of continuity that is basically saying that charge is conserved. So what we were originally after was to have the divergence of J to be zero, so we could say that the divergence of E was zero, so we could apply Laplace's equation. And you can see if we're in a steady state, that means that there's going to be no change in how the charge is distributed, and therefore we're going to get that the divergence of J is equal to zero. And therefore we're going to get the divergence of E is zero, and therefore we can apply Laplace's equation. Okay. Well, before we go and solve some Laplace's equations, roughly speaking, what's the time frame for getting to a steady state sort of situation? Because obviously non-steady state situations are possible. You can put some charge and then watch it drift away. Roughly how much time is that going to take? So our starting point is going to be the equation of continuity. We have the time derivative of rho plus the divergence of J having to be 0. And we know that J is equal to the conductivity times the electric field. And we know from Gauss's law that the divergence of the electric field is equal to the charge density. And if we're not in vacuum, if we're in material, then we know that that's going to be an epsilon. So we put that all together. What we've got is the time derivative of the charge density plus g divided by epsilon. The charge density has to be 0. And that's a differential equation you know how to solve, right? The first derivative of something is minus the something. So this means that the charge density deviations have to be decaying exponentially like that, where tau, well, maybe I'll write it as, so 1 over tau has to be g over epsilon, so that when we take the derivative of it, we get canceling terms. Okay, so we could plug in typical numbers for metals, and what we would find is this thing is very short, less than a nanosecond. And typically more like 10 to the minus 14 seconds in a good conductor. So if we start out with non-equilibrium charge distributions, they're very quickly going to settle down to be static sort of situations with a time constant that is given by that relationship. Okay. So as long as we're in a static situation, which we might have to wait 10 to the minus 14 seconds or so to occur, then we have divergence of J is 0, which means that the divergence of E is 0, which means that we can say that Laplace's equation is going to be satisfied for that voltage. So let's think about, you know, kind of the standard sort of problem that we could have. And what we're going to think about is where we have, I don't know, it could be a bubble in seawater, or it could be a copper sphere in seawater. What I have is a sphere that has some conductivity G, maybe I'll call it G2, and it's immersed in a fluid that has conductivity G1. And we have a current that's flowing at great distances that is uniform. And we're supposed to kind of figure out how this is going to work. And of course, if this were literally a bubble where G2 is equal to 0, then of course this current has to work its way around this bubble. If this thing is something like copper that's a better conductor than seawater, then we expect that the current is going to want to go through that piece of copper. And it all is going to depend on exactly what the conductivities are, the relative conductivities of the two materials we're thinking about. So the starting point for Laplace is to think about so we know what the solutions are going to be, right? We know, as usual, the general solution to Laplace in spherical coordinates is some A terms and some C terms and some Legendre polynomials. But the important, and we're going to have one set of solutions on the outside and one set of solutions on the inside. All of the sort of usual things are going to apply. But what we really need to do is how to set up the boundary conditions along that connect these two pieces of material. And we know that the voltages have to agree on the boundary. There has to be just one voltage. The other boundary condition, if you think about it, is that for any little piece of this sphere, as much current has to flow out of the sphere as is entering the new material. And what that requires then is that the normal component of J has to equal the normal component of J in the other material. And one of the reasons we're dealing with spheres, of course, is the normal direction is just going to be the radial direction. Okay, is the setup kind of clear? I mean, we've worked this problem lots of different ways now with conductors and with dielectrics, and now we're switching gears and we're thinking about where we have currents flowing.
So just a side question, the normal for the surface that that's why the opposite sign of currents. Like the normal
Well, so we just have one normal for that surface. So it's not that there's a different normal one and normal two. There's just one normal. And it kind of doesn't matter whether we take that to be the inward radial direction or the outward radial direction, because we're saying that they're the same. But typically, we're going to take it to be an outward going normal. More questions? Okay, so it's the usual story, right? Inside, we can't have any C terms because they would imply that something was going to infinity at the origin. So we're just going to have voltages that include A terms. Outside, generally speaking, we're not going to have any of these A terms. That should have been equal zero, not equal zero. But we do need to have something to make this long-term electric field. So we are going to allow ourselves an A1, R1 cosine theta term, where, of course, cosine theta is just P1, where this A1 term is exactly what's necessary to make a electric field at infinity. Okay, so with that little proviso, the outside field is only going to include the Cn terms, but then we have to allow this something to be producing the electric field at infinity. Right? And I hope you all remember the usual trick. We're writing this in spherical coordinates, but r times cosine theta is just z, and it's super easy to take the gradient of z, right? It's just in the z direction, the k hat direction. So that's producing an electric field that's just in the z hat direction. Now, if this works the way it's worked in the past, we're not going to have literally an infinite sum of terms, right? In the past, we've only needed terms out to n equals 2 in order to make this thing work. And it's really not going to be any different today than it's been with things like dielectric spheres. Okay, so let's write the boundary conditions. One boundary condition is that phi in evaluated on the surface of the sphere has to equal phi out evaluated on the surface of the sphere. So that says then that if we add up An capital R to the n Pn, we have to get the same thing as adding up Cn over R to the n plus 1 Pn. And then we have that special term that's required to make the constant electric field. And I think the way to think about this is that the Pn are like unit vectors in a high-dimensional vector space. And if vector A equals vector B, it means that the coefficient of those unit vectors has to be the same for A and for B. If we want to get fancy, we can multiply both sides of the equation by Pm and integrate and use orthogonality. It's all going to give us the same result in the end. Namely, that for n not equal to 1, we're going to have An R to the n has to equal Cn over R to the n plus 1. For n equal to 1, we're going to have A1 R to the 1 on this side of the equation, and on the other side of the equation, we're going to have C1 over R squared minus E naught R. And all we did for both of these is we equated the coefficient of Pn, remembering that cosine theta is P1. Okay, so from one equation, we get an infinite number of equations, just as you would get an infinite number of equations, three equations, for example, by saying that vector A equals vector B. It's just a matter of saying that the coefficients of the basis vectors have to be the same for those same vector spaces. Okay, so what we need for the other part is to equate the radial component of J inside, which I think I'm calling 2, and we want to evaluate that right on the surface of the sphere. That has to equal the value of J outside in the radial direction evaluated at the surface of the sphere. And one of these J's, of course, is going to be G times the radial component of E, and the radial component of E is going to be the derivative of R with respect to phi. So if we cancel our minus signs, what this is in fact going to say is that G2 derivative with respect to R of phi on the inside has to equal G1 derivative with respect to R of phi outside. And it should remind you a whole lot of what the boundary condition was for a dielectric sphere, right? There we said that dN didn't change when we went across the boundary because we didn't have any free charge on our sphere. And then these g's were really epsilons because to get d from e, we needed to multiply it by epsilon. Okay, so it should be pretty familiar stuff. Okay, so it's easy to take derivatives with respect to r of these functions. So we've got g2 add up, and we bring down the n, a n. We evaluate r at the boundary, which is where it counts. And we equate coefficients of, I guess I am not equating coefficients yet. We're about to equate coefficients of the pn. And so here we're going to have add up minus n plus 1 cn over r to the n plus 2 pn. And we have minus e naught P1, which is just cosine theta. And that's an E, not an epsilon naught. Okay? So now if we equate the coefficient of Pn and we deal with n not equal to 1, then we're going to have G2n an r to the n minus 1 has to equal G, make myself a little bit of room, has to be equal to minus n plus 1 g1 cn divided by r to the n plus 2. For n equals 1, we're going to have g2 a1 no r has to equal g1, and then we're going to have minus 2, I already have my g, c1 divided by r cubed. And we have the other remaining term, which is minus e naught. Okay, so all we're doing is equating the pn terms on either side of the equation. So the fast realization is that if we consider for any particular value of n, say n equals 10, here we have a linear equation with two unknowns, a10 and c10, but with no constant term on the right-hand side. Here we have a linear equation with a10 and c10 with no constant term on the other side. So what we have are homogeneous linear equations, and they have a trivial solution, right? The trivial solution is that a10 equals c10 equals 0. That perfectly solves those two equations. You might worry about that being a unique solution, but we're guaranteed by our uniqueness properties that there is only one solution to Laplace's equation. Or if you feel up to it, you can take the determinant of the coefficient matrix and show that the coefficient matrix isn't singular, doesn't have determinant 0, so it has an inverse. So no matter how you argue it, for n not equal to 1, an and cn are going to be 0. They certainly solve those equations. Now the other equations are inhomogeneous, meaning that there's a term in them, namely this term here, that doesn't depend on the unknowns a1 and c1. And inhomogeneous linear equations, we're going to have to solve by pick your favorite method. So first of all, let's kind of get these things into reasonable form. Let me divide this top equation through by R1 and bring the other term to the other side of the equation. So I have A1 minus C1 over R cubed is equal to 0. So everything is true except that I have this term also has an inhomogeneous term, namely minus E naught. Right, so this is the equation I'm dealing with. Divide it through by R and bring the C1 over to the other side of the equation. And for this one here, I think what I'm going to do is define G2 over G1 as something like a dielectric constant K. And then what I'm going to get is K times A1, that's going to be this term, plus 2C1 over R cubed is equal to minus E naught. Okay, so two equations, two unknowns. We can be off to the races. Choose your favorite method. I'm going to get rid of the C terms by multiplying the top equation by 3, or excuse me, by 2, and then adding. So what I'm going to get is K plus 2 times A1. These terms are going to cancel, and I'm going to get minus 3 E naught. So A1 is going to be minus 3 over K plus 2 E naught. Okay, so when you come up with these things, it's nice to check that they make sense. So if the piece that I called either a bubble or a copper sphere was seawater, that is to say, if the conductivities were the same, then the stuff should just flow right through, right? It was an imaginary surface then. So if I put K equals 1, I get that A1 equals E naught, right? And that's going to produce exactly the same electric field that I had at infinity. If I have highly conductive material, like copper, inside my sphere, then the electric field is going to be pretty small in highly conductive material like copper. And you can see that as K goes to infinity, highly conductive material on the inside, then the electric field is going to be small on the inside. On the other hand, if this is air on the inside that has a very small conductivity so that K is going to 0, then I still have an electric field on the inside, but it's bigger than it was before. Okay, so that's what A1 is. If we know what A1 is, we should be able to calculate C1. So C1 over R cubed, it's nice to have it normalized, is equal to A1 plus E naught. So if I add a E naught to what I've got, I'm going to have K plus 2 minus 3 divided by K plus 2 all times E naught, which is K minus 1 divided by K plus 2 times E naught. Okay, so once again, if this sphere is not made of anything that's different, so that K equals 1, there's going to be no dipole term And the only thing we're going to have is a constant electric field. If we have highly conductive material, kind of what do we expect is going to happen? Well, we expect that some of this current is going to be attracted into the highly conductive material, kind of like that. So that requires an additional field that is pointing in here and is pointing out there. And that's exactly what we get from a dipole field, right? So if K goes to infinity, what we're going to have is a dipole field that is doing exactly that sort of thing. If this is made out of air, then we better have a dipole field that is drawing the current around the bubble. So then we need a field that's going out here and is going to bring it back in here, and that's exactly the reverse of that dipole. So I don't know, I claim this all makes sense in terms of a solution. So it hasn't gone anywhere, it's still sitting there. So if I really wanted C1, I'd want to multiply it by R cubed. So let me describe a hard homework problem that I've assigned. It's a starred homework problem. So the problem starts with a sheet of metal. So it's basically a two-dimensional problem. And we're going to drill a hole right in the middle of this piece of metal. And I hope it's clear that cylindrical coordinates are going to be the right one. And the question is, by drilling a hole in this piece of metal, how does the resistance of this piece of metal change? So I don't know, you might make some kind of guesses that since you have reduced the cross-sectional area effectively by twice the radius, that maybe the resistance is going to increase by that factor. Or maybe it's the area that counts, right? So roughly speaking, how is the resistivity going to change? Now this is made complicated by having this be a finite piece of metal. Everything we've ever used before extended to infinity. So if we really wanted to work this problem with these finite boundaries, we'd have to solve it on a computer. But the problem says, let's pretend that this is in a piece of an infinite slab. And if it were infinite, we would find that the voltage is not a constant on this piece. And we'd find that the voltage is not a constant on this piece. So instead of talking about the voltage, we're going to talk about the average voltage over these slices. And same thing for the current. The current is not going to be coming in general, perpendicular to those areas. It's going to be coming in at an angle. And so what we're going to want to calculate is the total current, which is going to depend on just the current in the x direction. So we want to add up the total current that's going through this boundary. We want to calculate the average voltage that's on that boundary, and of course, we know that the resistance is going to be the voltage difference between these two pieces divided by the current. Okay, so it's an approximation.
What does that say by the J to the back?
So the current that's going in, it conceivably is going to be going at an angle, but the only current that's actually going through is going to be the current that's in the x direction. Right, where I'm defining this to be the x direction.
The arrow going the other way, but I don't know if I'm just going to remember the arrow.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to, you're right, it's going to be avoiding that bubble as opposed to being attracted to it. Okay, so it's, since it's cylindrical coordinates, we're going to be thinking about things that are, you know, a n, r the n, cosine n theta, etc. In order to make the constant electric field at infinity, we're going to have a term that is minus e naught r cosine theta, where this theta is now the cylindrical theta, not the spherical theta. And the tricky part, so solving this problem for the infinite case is pretty much like what we've done. The trickier part is now figuring out what the average voltage is on these sections and what the average current is, total current, excuse me, is on those sections, and calculating what the resistance is going to be. Okay. Okay, so we can apply Laplace's equation to solve these current problems just fine. So Laplace has come back to greet us again. So let's talk kind of about simpler things, simple wires. So I've already, I guess, mentioned this concept of resistance because I'm assuming that you're all familiar with V equals IR. If we have a long wire that has some length L and some cross-sectional area A, what's the resistance that we're going to have? Well, if we assume that the current density is uniform throughout the cross-sectional area, we can pretty easily attack this problem. And let me comment that this turns out to be true at any kind of laboratory sort of frequency. But at high enough frequency, there's a phenomenon called the skin effect, which ends up that the current doesn't like to be on the inside of the wire. It only hangs on to the outside of the wire. And we'll talk about that eventually. But to a pretty good approximation at normal laboratory frequencies, megahertz sort of frequencies and less, the current really is uniformly distributed across that cross section. So what we know then is that the current density depends linearly on the electric field. And the total current, since we're assuming it's uniform, is just the current density times the cross-sectional area. And we know that the electric field is just the change in the voltage divided by the length. Oops. So what we've got then, when we bring this over to the other side of the equation, is the resistance is the length divided by the area. And I'll put the G in the denominator, but most commonly you see this with the resistivity in the numerator. I'm sure that's how you saw it in 200. So long wires, thin wires have high resistance. How about power? And maybe we should start with energy. Power, of course, is just energy per time. So the energy is going to be the charge that's transferred times the voltage difference. And the charge that's transferred is going to be the current times the time. So for the power, take the energy and divide it by the time. It's just going to be the current times the voltage difference. And we can write this three different ways, right? We can substitute in that the current is equal to the voltage divided by R. So we can write this as V squared over R. Or we can write this as the voltage is equal to I times R, in which case this is I times R squared, right? All this, I hope, is familiar stuff from what you remember from 200. Somewhat familiar?
So let R, Q of R equals
So this is the resistance, this is the conductivity, and this is the length of the wire and the cross section of the wire. That's the length of the wire. And more commonly, you see this with the so if you look up in books, usually you don't find conductivities, you find resistivities. So more commonly, you see this with the fact that 1 over the conductivity is the resistivity. So resistivity times length divided by area. Long wires, thin wires have big resistances. Now, it might be worth commenting that for real wires, the area is specified by the gauge of the wire. And gauge is a backwards logarithmic system. So that big numbers mean thin wire. So like household wiring might be gauge 10 or 12. Wires that we typically use in electronics are more like 22 or 26. Pretty thin wire is like gauge 30. So you can look up the conversion factor if you want between gauge and radius. But you buy wire according to its gauge. And bigger numbers are thinner numbers. And as I say, it turns out the system is logarithmic. So that, I guess I don't know what the doubling gauge is. Okay, well, what do we do after that? You could ask my 106ers, and they tell you what obviously comes next, and our favorite guy, Kirchhoff. So let me comment, we're not going to do much with this. We'll come back to Kirchhoff's law when it gets more interesting, when we have AC circuits. But none of the homework problems, I think, use Kirchhoff's laws, but this way I can tell you when we reach AC circuits as you remember. Okay, so let's start with the easy part of Kirchhoff's laws, and that's just parallel and series stuff. So when we're thinking about a parallel combination of resistors, we're thinking that there's a choice, right? Parallel means that there's a choice. The current can go this way or it can go that way. And one of Kirchhoff's laws says that the current that flows in has to equal the current that flows out. So this total current that's flowing in this junction has to be the sum of the current that went this way and the current that went that way. I'm going to call these guys R1 and R2. All of these guys are connected to exactly the same wires, and so they have exactly the same voltage difference. So the current that's flowing through R2 we can calculate as the shared voltage divided by its resistance. And the current that's going through the other guy is just the voltage divided by its resistance. And the total current then, just the sum of the currents that went to the right and to the left, that's going to be 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2, all of that times voltage. If we put this thing over to the other side of the equation, we have 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2 inversed times I equals voltage. So this quantity here is called the effective resistance. And usually you see this equation written as 1 over the effective resistance is 1 over R1 plus 1 over R2. And if there were more parallel resistors, they would just be added on like that. It might be worth reminding you that we also had parallel capacitors, but for parallel capacitors, they just added up.
What does that say under
So it says effective or equivalent. You could choose your pick. Take your pick. Okay, so there's serial. With serial, there's no choice, right? So there's no exit ramp. Whatever current goes into the first resistor has to go into the second resistor. And if we know the voltage drop here and we know the voltage drop there, then we can obviously add those up to get the total voltage drop. So in this case here, the current is constant and the voltages add. In this parallel case, what we had is the voltage was constant, maybe I should say consistent between the two, and the currents add. Okay, so the voltage drop across R2, we can calculate as the shared current times R2, and the voltage drop across R1 is the shared current times R1. The total voltage drop is just the current times the total resistance. So the effective resistance is just the sum of the resistances. And you might remember for capacitors, this is the one that added up in inverse. So there's something a little bit tricky to remember that they don't work the same way. And the reason they don't work the same way is just where we put the constant. So for capacitors, we said that charge was equal to C times V, whereas for resistors, we said I times R equals V, right? So different sides of the equation.
Can you say that again?
So there's nothing fundamentally tricky about why one adds an inverse and one adds directly. It's just a matter of which side we put the constant on. If we decided to put this constant on the Q side of the equation and call it capacitance, then it would act just like resistances. It would add like this in parallel and like this in series. So it's not something that there's fundamental difference between capacitors and resistors. It's just a matter of where we put the proportionality constant, whether we put it on the V side of the equation or we put it on the Q side of the equation. Okay, so Kirchhoff's laws. So the so-called junction equation just says at any junction, the total current in is the current out. Which is just a consequence of the fact that charge doesn't build up anyplace. And that can sometimes cause problems for people because as a shorthand, we very commonly say that capacitors store charge. But it always stores equal and opposite charge so that as a whole, the capacitor is electrically neutral. And that means that whatever current flows in better be flowing out. Okay, so even though there's a break in the wire inside the capacitor, there still is continuous current going through the capacitor. Although it's not literally going through the capacitor, because nothing's going through this vacuum. Okay, so the loop rule, if we add up the voltage drops in a loop, by definition, we're going to get zero, right? So if you add up the heights that you gain or lose when you have a boundary water trip and your put-in spot is the same place that you put out, then as far as you went up, you had to go down, right? It works the same way with energy. So if you're canoeing and you're fighting the current, if the current is going this way but you're going the other way, then obviously you're going uphill. Whereas if you are If the current is going this way and you're paddling this way, then you're going downhill. Batteries correspond to these situations they used to have. I don't think they have them anymore, where trucks would carry you up and over the portage. So here we're going uphill. We're going from up. So you probably have forgotten the order of these symbols. I certainly would have if I hadn't just taught this to the 106ers. So the big line is the positive line, and the smaller line is the negative line of this battery. And if we're going like this, then we're going uphill, obviously. So all I have to do is add up all of these voltage changes. So to make kind of an arbitrary circuit, so I draw this somewhat arbitrary circuit because you can't break this circuit up into parallel and series pieces, right? Sometimes you can do that and solve these circuits the easy way. But this one, you can't break this down into parallel series circuits. And also, this is named for a famous dead physicist, Wheatstone. Okay, so what we want to do is arbitrarily put arrows on each wire, right? And this is a whole wire segment, so it only needs one definition. I'm going to call this one I with no subscript. I'm going to call the current in this one I1. I'm going to call the current in this one I2. I'm going to call the current in this one I3, and so it's going to go. And those are arbitrary labels. I could draw them any way I wanted to. But once I've drawn them, then it's a matter of how you're paddling. So if I make a loop, like this, then I went uphill through this battery, so it's going to be plus V, but I'm going with the flow through R1. So I'm going downhill with a voltage drop that is the current times that resistance. And I'm going downhill through this other one. And so the sum of those voltage drops has to be zero. I could have a loop kind of like this. There's no battery in there. But if here I have to paddle upstream, right? I'm fighting the flow, so I have to have a plus I1 R1 for that. Here I'm going with the flow, so it's minus I2 R2, and here I'm going with the flow, so it's minus I3 R3. Have to add up to zero. I don't know, just to pick a somewhat tricky one, we can go like this. So if I start here, I went uphill through the battery, I went downhill through R1, I had to fight the current through R3, then I went with the flow through I5. So the sum of those voltage drops has to be zero. So if you remember your 200, you know the name of the game is you write down these equations, you get N equations and N unknowns, and then you solve them.
Good thing none of us remember 200.
I was about to ask. So how many of you pretty much remember this? You go up two hands. How many of those remember it? A little bit. And how many? I would have never figured this out on my own.
How many is Google?
I want to see hands. Or am I seeing hands? Okay, so people.
Wait, what are we not in the last time?
So two hands is, I've seen this before, this is dull. One hand is, I kind of remember this a little bit. And no hands is, I know we did this, but I don't remember anything about this. Okay. So mostly people remember this, with with one exception. So, I mean, the good news is we're not going to bother to do this because it'd be too easy. We'll wait until it gets hard, when we have AC circuits. And we get complex numbers in, as opposed to just ordinary real numbers. And I don't know how much we're going to actually be dealing with numbers. I'll probably have some that's actually dealing with numbers. But if you don't know it, you should know that your calculators can solve n equations and unknowns, even if you can't. Right, so in this particular problem, we would have five unknown currents. So we would have five equations and five unknowns. And no one in their right mind would want to do that by hand. But if you look on your calculator, so what I recommended to my 106ers is you go to YouTube and you type, this stands for row reduced echelon form, which you probably vaguely remember from linear algebra. And maybe type in the word matrix, and then the name of your calculator. There, a lot of them have TI-83s. And you will find a nice video that shows you how to solve any equations and unknowns. With numbers, of course, not with letters. And I'll probably have some actual number sort of problems. But you know, of course, that the main point is to get the equations right. So if I have it on an exam, you'll certainly get 80% of the points by just writing down the equations correctly.
For that one problem.
Say again?
For that
one problem. For that one problem, yeah. Questions about Kirchhoff's laws? Okay, I think that pretty much finishes with that chapter. What does the next chapter hold? Well, we started out by saying that there are two things that you absolutely have to remember from this class, right? How to solve Laplace's equation, and this R prime sort of stuff. And since we've now very recently done Laplace's equation, what could be more natural than to have some R prime sort of stuff? So where the R prime stuff cropped up last time was where we were calculating things like electric fields by integration. Right? So we had 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, add up the vector that points from the source to our observation point. And then we had the little bit of charge, which was rho dv. And now what we've got are magnetic fields. So we should be looking for very similar sorts of formulas that apply to magnetic fields. Except we kind of know what to expect, right? So the thing that is like rho dv, we're thinking is going to become a JdV, a current density. Unless it's current that's flowing on the surface of a conductor, in which case it might be KdA. The book also uses lowercase j's for those. I may use them both interchangeably. Right, so this is like the surface charge density. Or we could have wires, IDL. So let me, first of all, comment about this thing, which is a little bit different. When we wanted currents, what we had was j dot dA, right? But what you see here is JdV. Why the difference? So one has a tendency to say that current is the source of a magnetic field, but it's not really the case. We can get a big magnetic field by having a big current or by having a long wire. So both the length of the wire and the current come into play. So if you look at the units of these sorts of things, well, let's deal with the top one. So the units of current density are amps per square meter, and we're multiplying that by a volume, so we're getting, of course, amp meters for our for the thing that we're adding up, right? So all of these things have units of amp meters. Right, so that's, of course, coulombs times meters per second. So one kind of difference between electric fields and magnetic fields is this factor of velocity that is going to crop up. So again, something that lots of you may remember from 200 is the formula for the force. So we have for electric fields that the force was just the charge times the electric field. For magnetic fields, we have this, you know, this crazy perpendicular sort of thing. And since force, of course, is going to have units of newtons and charge is going to have units of coulombs, I hope you can see that the units of E and the units of B have to differ by a factor of velocity. So we're going to need new units to describe these magnetic fields, which incidentally are going to be Teslas. Now, occasionally I've talked about other systems of units that are nice because they make nicer equations. They don't have these 4 pi epsilon naughts in them. So one of those, the aim is to make the electric field and the magnetic field have the same units. And that's a smart thing to do because I claim, if you look in your syllabus, I claim that the electric and magnetic fields are really versions of one thing. And if they really are a version of one thing, they really should have the same units. So for folks who like to write that, they write that force equation like that. So now the E and the B are going to have the same units, which, as I say, is a good sign for things that have, for which really are parts of the same thing. I got a little bit more time. So let me write down the equation. It's called the Biot-Savart law. That is the equivalent of this equation here, except for magnetic fields. And it's kind of no surprise that magnetic fields are trickier than electric fields, right? We got this tricky cross product in the force equation. And we're going to have a tricky cross product in the source equation. So what we're going to have is IDL. And if you don't like IDL, you can pick any one of these because they're all equally currents, crossed into R minus R prime divided by the magnitude of R minus R prime cubed. So the plan is pretty much like what we did at the start, right? We started out with special charge situations, a spherical shell, a infinite plane, and we were able to use this equation in order to calculate what the electric field was for those particular situations. So now we've got a more complicated formula for what the magnetic field is, so we're going to want to calculate what the magnetic field is for a long straight wire, for current that is flowing along the surface of a plane, for all of those sort of standard situations. But in the end, we calculate lots of electric fields by using Gauss's law, right? Because it's way simpler than doing this integral. If we have a lot of symmetry, Gauss's law is going to tell us what the electric field is. And the same thing is going to be true for these magnetic fields. There's a shortcut that, in cases of lots of symmetry, allows us to calculate the corresponding magnetic field that goes in the name of Ampere's law. And I'll write it for no particular reason. instead of this being a surface integral, this is going to be a line integral. And if we go around in a loop, we're going to get the enclosed current. Yeah. So we've had other mu's, and this is not any of them.
Is that a mu naught?
That's a mu naught. So it's like this epsilon naught. It's a universal constant you can look up in your book, except turns out that this universal constant has a universal value. It's exactly equal to 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7th in SI units, whereas epsilon naught, approximately speaking, is an experimental value. You might wonder how it's possible to have a fundamental constant that is a known value like that. It's just a matter of how you've set up your units. Not surprisingly, in these other sort of equations where you try and get rid of things like that, that stuff is gone. And then you have crazy units for your current. Okay, so I think in the assignments.txt, I comment that the next chapter, I think, looks scary. And it's maybe not as scary as it seems. We're mostly going to be concerned in that whole chapter with just this equation, just calculating magnetic fields from current distributions. So if it looks like it's going over your head, I guess that's okay, because this is what we'll be doing for a while with it. Well, maybe I'll give one final word. Voltages were way easier to deal with for electric fields. And we had the electric field was minus the gradient of the voltage. So you might hope that there would be something that was going to make magnetic fields easy. Well, there is something like it, but it doesn't make it easy. Because everything gets vectorishes, instead of having gradients, we have curls. And you know that curls are way more complicated than gradients. And this is a whole vector as opposed to just one thing. And approximately speaking, this is useless. Its main purpose is to prove theorems. It's not really much good for calculation. And in particular, we're going to need this in order to prove Ampere's law, at least in a reasonably easy way. Okay, so. Yeah, so did I assign some of those problems before? So this is the second 200 exam as opposed to the first. So when we're doing capacitors, I assigned some of them? You might as well do them again, right? They're in a big block. They're multiple choice questions.
Yeah.